Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 131. It's Monday, September 13th. I am recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Okay, well, COVID-19 continues to rage in Ohio and Lucas County. So let's start with the local COVID-19 update. Well, folks, as I've been pointing to for quite a while, Ohio is now the fastest growing hotspot among states. We saw it a couple months ago start with an epicenter in Missouri, move down to the southern tier states, and then started moving up through Tennessee. Kentucky's been having a real problem the last couple weeks, and sure enough, Ohio is at the crest of that wave, and we're seeing Ohio and Lucas County accelerate in the number of cases. And as I've pointed out before, nationally, it is true both nationally, state, and locally that the unvaccinated are now at the greatest risk they have been yet in this pandemic. Okay, well, some interesting news. The Toledo-Lucas County Health Department had a media conference last week, and one of the things they pointed out that's relevant here is that we are now seeing outbreaks in Lucas County from people who've been exposed outdoors. Yes, sirree, folks, this is the coronavirus 3.0, the Delta virus, which is way more contagious. The original virus did not do very well in outdoor, but here, if you're gathering around other folks outside, still need to take some precautions. Okay, well, the average number of daily cases has bumped up to over 200 at 201, up from 170 last week. The weekly rate of 350 cases per 100,000 per week for the state of Ohio is over seven times that of what Governor DeWine indicated he wanted to have when he wanted to remove the statewide mask mandate. And have we seen or heard of any evidence on the horizon of a statewide mask mandate? Well, I asked our local health commissioner, who meets regularly with other health commissioners in the Ohio Department of Health, and there's no sign of a statewide mask mandate. Although I'm going to make a bold prediction here. I think that in the next few weeks, the governor, in his non-metric, put his finger to the wind, gauge the political costs, will eventually put a statewide mask mandate. This is going to continue to hit us hard. We're already up to over 3,000 COVID-19 cases in the hospital currently today in the state of Ohio. And that's pushing well over half of what our highest has ever been at 5,000, which was over the December-January period. Okay. Testing positivity rates continue to go up. They've reached 15% in Lucas County. That's up from 12.6% last week. Our testing volume has leveled off, probably not a good thing, and test results are usually two or three days to get your results back. In Ohio, the positivity rate bumped up to 13.8 from 12.1% last week. So again, we're increasing quickly here. And it looks like testing is not increasing as quickly as the virus is. So we're falling further behind. Okay, nursing homes in Lucas County, long-term care facilities, they bumped up to 35 active cases from 32 last week, which is about a doubling from a couple of weeks ago. 14 residents and 21 staff have active cases in long-term care facilities. Okay, well, one of the big drivers that we've seen across the country and statewide, and looks like Lucas County as well, is schools. Okay, this most recent week, 242 students identified as positive in the most recent week, and 33 staff. That's up from the previous week of 32 staff and 120 students. So the number of students doubled from the most recent week to the prior week. And I want to remind my listeners here that only about 1 in 7 school-age Ohioans are fully vaccinated. So school children are largely unvaccinated. Now, of course, a large percent of those 12 to 18-year-olds could be vaccinated, but they are not. Okay, well, UT, our other tracking of higher education here, they doubled the number of identified cases up to 33 from 16 in the prior week. Good news, though, as far as their surveillance testing, they only had a 0.3% positivity rate. That was 2 identified cases out of several hundred that they tested. This is sort of random testing of students. Of course, that would still mean, if you expand that 0.3% to the entire student body of over 20,000 UT students, that there are still a lot of unidentified cases floating around. Well, I'll repeat, from last week, reporting on the UT mandating vaccines, they require proof by November 15th, so we'll have to see how quickly that gets the student body vaccinated. If a student or a staff member chooses not to get vaccinated, then they have to take weekly COVID-19 tests. Okay, well, as I mentioned earlier, hospitalizations are still steadily rising in both Lucas County and Ohio. In Lucas County, we're seeing about 25 new COVID-19 hospital admissions each day. 25 new hospital COVID-19 admissions per day in Lucas County. And Ohio's cracked the over 3,000 mark in people that are in the hospital for COVID-19 today. Okay, well, kind of the story, and they covered this at the Toledo Lucas County Health Department media conference the end of last week, and that is that 77% of local PEDS ICU beds are full, and that is, quote, really unusual. And what's really driving that is that kids are being co-infected with COVID-19 and RSV, the respiratory syncytial virus, which is a very common virus, but the RSV has started circulating, quote, earlier than ever, and another quote, never seen this before. So this is really unusual, and of course, RSV can be serious for little kids, particularly, but putting it along with COVID-19 can make it really dangerous. Yikes. Okay, well, turning nationally, deaths have surpassed 1,600 a day, although it does seem that the rate of increase seems to be slowing a bit, but still, yikes. Okay, vaccinations are trudging along very slowly. We have reached 53.8% nationally of people that are fully vaccinated. That's still under half of the people for Ohio and Lucas County, with Ohio at 48.9% and Lucas County at 48.0%. Ohio has not seen a big surge in vaccination with a surge in cases recently. Hopefully that will change. Okay, well, now I want to do an update on the Toledo Lucas County Library, which we've been doing as a case study of how fragmented and devolved decision-making has stymied our public health response to COVID-19. And last week reported they didn't even have signage up, let alone a mask mandate. Well, things have changed a bit. They have distributed posters to be placed near the entrances that say, in accordance with current public health guidance, thank you for wearing a mask in all library spaces. and they actually have masks available for people that don't have them, although the staff are not asking people to mask if they're not. And here is what they're telling their staff. Quote, "We are recommending that all customers in our spaces wear masks and want to share language with you to encourage that behavior. Please talk with your management team and colleagues to be sure you are all comfortable sharing this message. For customers that ask, do I need to wear a mask? Short answer, yes, please, we'd like you to wear a mask. Longer answer if needed, the library is following public health advisories by strongly encouraging masks in our locations. If the customer refuses, we are only recommending, not requiring, so they may proceed with library access or services. For customers wondering why we don't have a mask requirement, the short answer is, without a federal or state mandate, the library has decided not to require masks for visitors. When we have to enforce mask wearing, our past experiences have shown it can lead to dangerous confrontations, especially when there isn't a mask mandate. If expansion is needed in that answer, instead, we are supporting current health department protocol by highly encouraging mask wearing through signage, conversations, having masks available, distributing free at-home COVID test kits, which, by the way, are available at your library, and hosting vaccine clinics in collaboration with the Toledo-Lucas County Health Department. Library staff are required to wear masks to support a layered approach to COVID prevention, that is, vaccines, masks, social distancing, improved ventilation, and increased disinfection. The library does require visitors to wear masks in our large event space where social distancing isn't possible. For customers wondering why we don't have a vaccine requirement for vaccine mandates of staff, Toledo-Lucas County Public Library is not considering a vaccine mandate for our staff. We are confident at least 85% of our staff are vaccinated, and a mandate would not move the needle in any useful way. For vaccine mandates for visitors, the library is not considering a vaccine mandate for visitors. Without a state mandate or vaccine passport system, this is not currently a realistic option and would limit important access to library services to our most vulnerable community members." Whew, I find that. Okay, so that's their official communication that they have to all their staff. That last little thing is kind of an interesting note, you know, to our most vulnerable community members. Of course, protecting from COVID-19 is one of the greatest vulnerabilities we can have in our community here. So I guess the question is, are these efforts resulting in patrons masking and keeping us safe? Okay, well, last week I did get a chance to speak with the executive director. And it happens that that day that I spoke with him, a branch was closed for cleaning due to known COVID-19 exposure. Now, they didn't release whether that was a staff person or a customer, but obviously it was some known exposure, so they wanted to do some cleaning and open the next day. Okay, well, on observing patrons at four different branches today and speaking to a staff member, it looks like about 70 to 80% of patrons are wearing masks. Not great, but probably somewhat better than retail stores. I wouldn't hang out at the library. If you need to be there, keep your visit brief and wear your mask. In sum, the coronavirus still has a lot of wiggle room to infect those in the library. Be very careful. The virus is raging, and indoor public spaces without universal masking is iffy at best. You are listening to WAKT 106.1 FM. This is Just for the Health of It, the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, well, let's continue with some COVID-19 news. This first story from Science Daily may seem like a no-brainer, especially for those who listen to my show regularly, but here goes. New study on COVID-19 vaccinations in the largest U.S. cities finds stark inequities. In a study of the nine largest U.S. cities, researchers at Columbia University School of Public Health found stark racial, ethnic, and socioeconomic inequities in COVID-19 vaccination rates across neighborhoods. The study showed that high vaccination neighborhoods had more white residents, fewer people of color, higher incomes, and lower poverty rates. These high vaccination neighborhoods also had lower historical COVID-19 death rates, showing that life-saving vaccines have been slow to reach the areas that were hardest hit by the pandemic. Using data on COVID-19 vaccination and death rates from state and local health authorities, the researchers sorted neighborhoods into four groups in order of vaccination rate, which they defined as the fraction of adults with at least one dose. Neighborhoods in the lowest vaccination group had less than half the vaccination rate of those in the highest group, 28% versus 60%. To assess inequities, the researchers then linked these neighborhoods with sociodemographic data from the American Community Survey. Racial disparities were particularly large. In the lowest vaccination neighborhoods, 25% of the population was black and 52% was white, while in the highest vaccination neighborhoods, just 6% of the population was black and 70% was white. There were also large disparities by income. The average low vaccination neighborhood had half the median income and over twice the poverty rate of the average high vaccination neighborhood. So I really just wanted to do this story to emphasize that vulnerability to COVID-19 is great even by neighborhood. For instance, my neighborhood, my zip code 43620, right in the Old West End, wonderful neighborhood, but it has one of the lowest vaccination rates of any zip code in the county. And that vaccination rate is just over half of what it is in the highest zip codes, highest vaccination rates for other zip codes. Okay, well, next up from Medical Express, more good news about confirming the fact that vaccines are effective against the Delta variant. COVID-19 vaccines are effective at preventing hospitalizations and emergency department visits caused by the Delta variant, according to data from a national study. That data also indicate that Moderna's vaccine is significantly more effective against Delta than Pfizer and Johnson & Johnson. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention analyzed more than 32,000 medical encounters from 9 states during June, July, and August when the Delta variant became the predominant strain. The results showed that unvaccinated individuals with COVID-19 are 5 to 7 times more likely to need emergency department care or hospitalization, similar to the overall effectiveness prior to the variant. The study in the Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report is also the first analysis to show a marked difference between the effectiveness of the mRNA vaccines, Moderna and Pfizer. In the study's time period, Moderna was 95% effective at preventing hospitalizations among adults age 18 and older. Pfizer was 80% effective at preventing hospitalizations among adults. And Johnson & Johnson was 60% effective at preventing hospitalizations among adults. So this is pretty good prediction overall, but this study has shown one of the wider variances. Of course, there are a lot of studies that shown pretty high levels of effectiveness, and of course, there's some variances between the studies. The bottom line is that vaccines do protect way more than not being vaccinated. And just as a reminder that this is a pandemic, a worldwide pandemic, this from Medical Express. The World Health Organization says Africa already thin vaccine supply to drop by 25%. Africa's already thin supply of COVID-19 vaccines has taken another significant hit, with the World Health Organization's Africa director saying last Thursday that for various reasons, including the rollout of booster shots, we will get 25% less doses than we are anticipating by the end of the year. Matshidiso Moeta's comments to reporters came as the Africa Center for Disease Control and Prevention said just over 3% of people across the African continent have been fully vaccinated. That coverage drops to around 1.7% in sub-Saharan Africa, according to the World Health Organization. African health officials are dismayed by the announcement that global COVAX effort to distribute vaccines to low- and middle-income countries is again cutting its delivery forecast. That revision, Moeti told reporters, is, quote, in part because of the prioritization of bilateral deals over international solidarity. The COVAX challenges, along with export controls on vaccine doses and their introduction of booster shots by some countries, really means at the end that there has to be a calculation, a projection that we will get 25% less doses than we were anticipating before the end of the year. Moeti noted that while COVAX has delivered over 5 million vaccine doses to African countries in the past week, 3 times as many doses have been thrown away in the United States alone since March. Every dose is precious, Moeti said, adding that high-income countries have pledged to share 1 billion doses globally, but so far only 120 million doses have been released. If companies and countries prioritize vaccine equity, this pandemic would be over quickly. The WHO says the target of vaccinating 10% of people in Africa by the end of this month is being missed. The goal is to vaccinate 40% by the end of the year. Okay, this next story from Medical Express is particularly newsworthy since we're getting hitting hard right now locally. COVID-19 infections in friend family groups may influence vaccine willingness. Overall, participants who did not have a friend or family member infected, hospitalized, or die because of COVID-19 were at least two times more likely to refuse vaccines compared to those who had someone in their social networks who was affected by COVID-19 infection. Yep, just goes to show that prevention as an abstraction is very difficult for many people. Yep, that kind of planning, higher executive functions is just a hard thing to push through. But of course, when you get hit hard when a friend or family member gets infected, hospitalized, or die, it seems to become a little bit more real, a little closer to home, and people are more likely to be vaccinated. May at least that be some silver lining to the cloud of COVID that is coming over us right now. If you aren't currently vaccinated and you are eligible, please get vaccinated, fully vaccinated. The following message contains just enough truth to scare just enough people to scare just about everyone. Dihydrogen monoxide exposure is rampant across the globe. Dihydrogen monoxide is found at high concentrations wherever life is found. You cannot escape it. Did you know that more people have died after recent exposure to dihydrogen monoxide than have died from any of the leading causes of death? What kind of conspiracy is this that so-called experts dismiss so casually? What you will never hear is that virtually every public health expert will concede privately that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide in the days before death is commonplace. However, publicly, virtually every public health expert will deny that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide is a leading cause of death. While dihydrogen monoxide is literally raining down on us, their silence is thunderous. Don't let broad scientific consensus water down these alarming facts. Our fear is real, and our privilege. Tell your friends about the dihydrogen monoxide conspiracy before it's too late. This dire warning has been brought to you by the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, where we explain everything as there is nothing to it. Here at the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, we know in our gut that without dihydrogen monoxide, drinking the Kool-Aid would be impossible. Okay, well, next up, from Medical Express, Republicans less likely to accept Affordable Care Act subsidies to purchase health insurance. Republicans who buy individual health plans may be less likely to shop through marketplaces created under the federal Affordable Care Act, leading to them foregoing subsidies provided by the federal government, according to a new study. Examining the behavior of enrollees of a large health plan in New England, researchers found that Republicans who bought individual plans were less likely than Democrats to make use of subsidies that they were eligible to receive, foregoing an average of about $800 annually as compared to similar Democrats. Neither Republican nor Democrat subscribers fully took advantage of all the subsidies that were available to them, but researchers found that the overall financial impact of not making use of subsidies was roughly double for Republicans as compared to Democrats. The study found Republican subscribers in non-group health plans generally were less likely to enroll through the ACA marketplaces than Democratic subscribers with the same socioeconomic profile. So the non-group just means that if you're trying to get insurance just for your individual family, not through like a group employer, and seeking it through other private insurance sellers. However, there was no difference in the ACA marketplace participation or subsidy take-up by party among people in the lowest income groups, those with less than 250% of the federal poverty level, who are eligible for subsidies worth thousands of dollars. Yep, if you're poor, you don't leave money on the table. Similarly, no party differences were observed among those who had chronic illnesses, who typically have higher overall healthcare spending. In other words, if you've got expensive healthcare and the premiums are high, you'll take the subsidy. That's the way it works. Okay, well, next up, also from Medical Express, and also about health coverage working, Medicaid expansion tied to improvements in blood pressure and glucose control. Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act has been linked with better quality of care and service capacity at federally qualified health centers or community health centers. but there is little evidence of the long-term impact of this expansion on community health centers nationwide. A new study led by the Boston University School of Public Health has found that Medicaid expansion is associated with a reduction in uninsurance as well as improvements in blood pressure and glucose control measures at federally qualified health centers in the 5 years after the expansions were implemented. These improvements were highest among Black and Hispanic patients. Despite these longer-term improvements, racial and ethnic disparities among Black and Hispanic populations persist even after the expansion. So efforts to expand insurance coverage should be accompanied by policy and programmatic changes that address structural racism and other systemic inequities, the researchers say. Yep, expanding coverage improves health.
It started in Norway in 1912, and they won't stop until everybody has health care. The infestation of health care for all has spread to dozens of nations. It could descend upon us from the north at the hands of those crafty Canadians. No wall can keep them out. It could rise up from the south, from those colluding Cubans just 90 miles away. Either might export their higher life expectancy and trample our God-given right to die prematurely. It's what Jesus would do. They're coming to take away your deductibles and copays. They will annihilate out-of-network providers. Protect your right to bet your loved one's health on for-profit healthcare conglomerates and the loving care of pharmaceutical corporations. Who cares if we pay twice as much for sicker citizens than nations who assure healthcare for all? That's just the price of freedom. The best deal ever. Better to pay extortion prices to corporate persons than pay even half that amount in taxes to the government of these somewhat United States. Think about it. Your neighbor could get health care whenever they need it. So could casual acquaintances. Even your political enemies would be indiscriminately spared preventable deaths. Don't let them take away our freedom to be sick without health care. Now, back to your community programming, powered by community togetherness.
Okay, well, next up from Medical Express as well, this relates to the fact that abortion care is being limited progressively more and more, or maybe I should say conservatively more and more, in recent months and years. Study: banning abortion would boost maternal mortality by double digits. Banning abortion nationwide would lead to a 21% increase in the number of pregnancy-related deaths overall and a 33% increase among Black women, according to a new University of Colorado research. Forthcoming in the journal Demography, the study estimates only the portion of increased deaths that would be due to complications of being pregnant and of delivering a baby. Any increased deaths due to unsafe abortions or attempted abortions would be in addition to these estimates. The takeaway here is that if you deny people abortion, pregnancy-related deaths will increase because staying pregnant is more dangerous to a woman than having an abortion, said author Amanda Stevenson, an assistant professor of sociology. The paper comes as Texas enacts the most restrictive abortion law in the country, banning the procedure after about 6 weeks, a time when many women don't yet know they are pregnant. Similar laws have been passed in at least 10 other states, but all face legal challenges. Stevenson, a demographer who studies the impacts of reproductive health policies, said that media outlets and some supporters of abortion rights often raise the specter of dangerous back alley or self-induced abortions. In reality, deaths from such incidents, which numbered in the hundreds annually prior to the 1973 passage of Roe v. Wade, could be far less common today due to the advent of safe, self-managed abortions using medications, including mifepristol, available via prescription or online. We expect a lot of women will turn to these safer forms of self-managed abortion, but a lot of women will also just stay pregnant, said Stevenson. What happens then? To predict the maternal mortality consequences, Stevenson used published statistics on the number of abortions and birth that occurred annually in recent years, calculated how many more pregnancies would be continued in the absence of legal abortion, and applied pregnancy-related mortality statistics to that number. Carrying a pregnancy to term is 33 times riskier than having an abortion. Research also shows that those most likely to seek abortion care, including women of color, poor women, and those with chronic or acute health conditions, are also more likely to encounter serious complications during pregnancy. The study estimated that in the years following a national ban, an additional 140 women would die annually from pregnancy-related causes, bringing the death toll to 815, a 21% increase. Among non-Hispanic black women, pregnancy-related deaths would increase by a third. Black women are more likely to seek an abortion for a variety of reasons, including unequal access to opportunities like housing, education, jobs, and health care. Meanwhile, the mortality risk of carrying a pregnancy to term is more than three times as high for non-Hispanic black women compared to non-Hispanic white women. Increasing black women's exposure to the risk of pregnancy-related mortality is denying them access to abortion would exacerbate an existing public health crisis, Stevenson said. The paper does not include an estimate of increased deaths due to unsafe self-induced abortion. A recent study showed about 1.5% of reproductive age women have tried to terminate a pregnancy themselves, often using ineffective and potentially unsafe methods like herbs, drugs, or objects. Well, I do think this article does miss a little bit in its tenor as far as kind of minimizing the effect of back alley or self-induced abortions. If that numbered in the hundreds prior to Roe v. Wade, sure, they may be less common, but if it's in the hundreds, even if it's half that, that's still as many as the 140 extra women that this researcher projected would die from pregnancy-related causes. So either way, hundreds of women from whatever cause, both of those causes could easily result in many, 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 many more deaths, meaning hundreds of more deaths. Okay, well, next up I have three stories on racism and public health. This from Medical Express. Study shows contact with police may be detrimental to health, well-being of black youth. According to a Johns Hopkins Medicine study published in JAMA Pediatrics, exposure to police, even in instances in which the officers are providing assistance, may be detrimental to the health and well-being of black youth, especially males, and can be associated with poor mental health, substance use, risky sexual behaviors, and impaired safety. The researcher defined police exposure as both contact with police, including presence of police in schools, personal experiences ranging from benign stops and interactions to use of force and arrest, and witnessed encounters, and perceptions of police discrimination. The health outcomes they assess included physical health, mental health, risk behaviors such as substance abuse, and safety. The study team revealed that contact with police often leads to black youth being treated as adults at ages when they should be just children, a phenomenon known as adultification. The researchers also found that black youth described a constant fear for their lives, hopelessness, and feelings of alienation from society at large, given the lack of support from social institutions such as law enforcement. We know that a sense of belonging is crucial to child development, and therefore exposures with police may have far-reaching impact on these children, explained senior author Dr. Rachel Thornton, associate professor of pediatrics at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. In fact, of the few studies we reviewed that followed children into adulthood, all showed relationships with poor health as adults as well. Overall, our review found that the current body of scientific evidence, although limited, reveals a definitive relationship between police exposure and adverse health outcomes for black youth. What is jarring was recognizing the ubiquitous and pervasive nature of these encounters, with studies included in our review taking place in grade schools, predominantly white institutions, historically black colleges, neighborhoods of varying racial composition, streets, parks, etc. She adds that while there isn't enough scientific evidence yet to prescribe a single solution for the problem of police exposure and its health impacts, understanding and acknowledging its persistence over decades, based on the findings of this review, is a solid first step in the right direction. She believes the future strategies might include youth-specific approaches to policing, teaming law enforcement and healthcare professionals to identify, target, and avoid the practices and behaviors that perpetuate detrimental health outcomes, making environments such as schools less threatening by reducing police presence, and supporting legislation and community reforms that mitigate the health impacts of police exposure on youth. Healthcare providers, especially those who take care of children, and law enforcement officers exist within institutions that are predominantly white and wield a great deal of power, so they both must be willing to take a critical look at the ways in which racism is perpetuated, both by themselves as individuals and by the social entities in which they work. That insight can be turned into actions that give black youth hope for a brighter and healthier future. Okay, next up from the Columbus Dispatch. Black children are twice as likely to die by suicide, nationwide children's study finds. Black children ages 5 to 12 are twice as likely to die by suicide as their white counterparts, a new study from Nationwide Children's Hospital shows. Research on suicide by black youth is extremely limited, so the study sought to identify the circumstances that arise when young black people take their own lives. Black girls, the study found, were more likely to experience a crisis with a boyfriend or girlfriend prior to death and died by suicide within 24 hours of an argument. Black boys were more likely to have experienced a recent legal problem, and when compared with black girls, were less likely to have received prior mental health treatment, the study found. Younger children who died by suicide, especially those 5 to 11 years of age, were more likely than older children to have experienced family and school problems. The study, published in the Journal of American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, also found suicide was increasing among black girls twice as fast as in black boys. The nationwide children's study comes as the number of Ohio children dying by suicide has increased in recent years, according to data from the Ohio Department of Health. In kids aged 10 to 14, there were 6 suicides reported in 2010, the lowest point in the 15 years of data. In 2019, 31 children aged 10 to 14 died by suicide, the most reported in any year since 2007. And by the way, listeners, this is National Suicide Prevention Month. Okay, next up from Medical Express, do doctors treat pain differently based on their patient's race? The answer is yes. Physicians prescribed opioids more often to their white patients who complained of new onset low back pain than to their black, Asian, and Hispanic patients during the early days of the national opioid crisis, when prescriptions for these powerful painkillers were surging, but their dangers were not fully apparent, according to a UCLA study. The findings suggest that doctors may have commonly dispensed pain treatment unequally based on race and ethnicity. The study shows that physicians were more likely to prescribe non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, or NSAIDs, as a less powerful alternative to their patients of color who came to them for back pain care. This appears to be a case of differential treatment of pain or bias by physicians, in which the pain of certain patients deserves opioids and the pain of others does not, says Dr. Dan Lai, the study's author and assistant professor of medicine at the UCLA School of Medicine. The fact that, in hindsight, more white patients develop dangerous long-term opioid use doesn't absolve physicians for this differential treatment. Well, this is kind of interesting because it's one of those unusual cases where actually racism benefited people, benefited people of color in this case, because actually in a lot of pain things, actually the NSAIDs, those anti-inflammatory drugs other than opioids, actually provides pretty good pain relief and doesn't have the same kind of negative side effects. So, well, that's kind of a rarity, but either way, it points out the racism in healthcare. Okay, well, next up, I got a bunch of stories that get more to the negative effects of capitalism on our healthcare system. First up from Stat News, FDA misses deadline for deciding which e-cigarette product should be removed from the market. The Food and Drug Administration announced last Thursday that it failed to meet a court-ordered deadline for deciding which e-cigarette products can stay on the market. In fact, it has yet to rule on whether any of the largest and most controversial e-cigarette companies, including Juul, can keep selling their products. Tobacco control advocates and vaping industry supporters alike are furious, and the delay could land the FDA back in federal court. A federal judge ordered the agency in April 2020 to decide by September 9, 2021, which e-cigarette products can stay on the market and which must be pulled off the shelves, but the agency has now blown past that deadline. The delay also drew ire from Capitol Hill. FDA's years-long failure to regulate e-cigarettes has led millions of kids who never would have picked up a tobacco product to begin vaping, wrote Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois in a statement. While I am pleased the FDA has rejected all e-cigarette applications to date for failing to show a health benefit, it is unacceptable to delay evaluation of e-cigarettes most responsible for hooking children, like Juul. The FDA statement also frustrated vaping industry advocates, who have been angered in recent days by the FDA's effort to shut down small vape shops while pushing off decisions on larger vaping companies like Juul. It is absolutely absurd that the same agency that found time to ban over 6 million vaping products manufactured by small businesses is now indicating the need more time to review products with massive market shares, said Greg Connolly, president of the American Vaping Association, a vaping advocacy group. Okay, next up, some more sketchy FDA performance. This from Medical Express. Third of cancer drugs without proven clinical benefit continue to be recommended for patients. One third of cancer drugs that received accelerated approval from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration continue to be recommended in clinical guidelines after their confirmatory clinical trials failed to show improvement on their primary endpoints, finds a study published in the British Medical Journal. The FDA's accelerated approval pathways allow drugs on the market before their effectiveness has been proven to hasten patients' access to promising new drugs. But as part of this approval, the manufacturers must conduct post-approval trials to confirm clinical benefit, improve survival, or quality of life in the case of cancer drugs. If these trials show no benefit, the drug's approval can be withdrawn. However, post-approval trials can be delayed for several years, and the FDA has until very recently been slow in taking steps to withdraw the drug or indication when these trials are conducted and fail to demonstrate clinical benefit. So a team of researchers in Canada and the U.S. set out to investigate how the FDA handles cancer drugs that received accelerated approval but had negative post-approval trials, and whether these negative trials change treatment guidelines. They searched the FDA database for all cancer drugs granted accelerated approval from the start of the program in 1992 until December 2020 and identified 18 indications for 10 cancer drugs that failed to show clinical benefit in post-approval trials. Of these, the approvals for 11, 61%, were voluntarily withdrawn. One was revoked, and six, or a third of them, remained on the drug's label over an average of 4 years. The researchers then reviewed the latest FDA and National Comprehensive Cancer Network guidelines and found that most of these drugs continued to receive high-level endorsement, sometimes even after approval for the given indications being withdrawn or revoked. This is the most comprehensive study of its kind so far, and the findings reflect the lack of fulfillment of the compromise between speed and evidence that underpins the accelerated approval pathway. Okay, well, the next couple stories use Aduhelm, this new Alzheimer's drug, as an example of why things can go wrong in our medical care system. This from Scientific American. Alzheimer's Inc., when a hypothesis becomes too big to fail. Aducanumab, marketed as Aduhelm, is an anti-myeloid monoclonal antibody and the latest in a procession of such drugs to be tested against Alzheimer's disease. Over the last several decades, billions have been spent targeting the amyloid that clumps together to form the neuritic plates, first documented by German psychiatrist Alois Alzheimer in 1906. This class of drugs has reduced amyloid aggregation. However, since 2000, there has been a virtual 100% fail rate in clinical trials, with some therapies actually worsening patient outcomes. The debacle is a microcosm of how the medical industrial complex has taken hold within the Alzheimer's field for decades, distorting science and policy while limiting other promising avenues of research and action on brain health and the care of persons living with dementia. At the heart of this problem is that the field has ossified in decidedly unscientific fashion around the amyloid cascade hypothesis, that is, the belief that amyloid is toxic and initiates processes disrupting cell function. This has funneled federal, foundation, and pharmaceutical and venture capital funding disproportionately into amyloid research, despite the fact that the protein's causal role remains unclear. Indeed, up to 40% of people in their 70s have amyloid deposits but normal cognition. It remains a possibility that amyloid deposits are not themselves causal, but rather are part of the brain's injury response. Moreover, despite its singular label, Alzheimer's is increasingly understood as a heterogeneous syndrome, involved not merely the hallmark amyloid plaques and tau tangles, but other features such as vascular changes. A majority of clinical Alzheimer's cases are in fact actually observed to be mixed dementias. It is perhaps unsurprising that attacking one aspect of the syndrome, amyloid, has not cured Alzheimer's. However, it is surprising to witness the field's inability to modify or abandon the amyloid hypothesis in light of contravening evidence. such as the stultifying effect of the medical-industrial complex, which has aligned incentives with fame and fortune based on the pursuit of single-mechanism drugs rather than the clear-eyed scrutiny demanded by the scientific method. Constituted in this narrow fashion, the gatekeepers control the field's agenda. What some have referred to as the Alzheimer's cabal have exerted strong downward pressure to endorse the amyloid hypothesis. Journals, conferences, and professional societies promote and reward research endorsing the conventionally accepted premises. Careers are built and consulting opportunities gained by massing publications and funding based on received wisdom. Meanwhile, those challenging the dominant agenda have been marginalized, with funding flowing away from other plausible theories of causation. To question whether it is even reasonable to expect biotechnology to cure a condition as complex and intimately age-related as Alzheimer's syndrome has been treated as heresy. The reductive, molecular, industry-driven approach has also narrowed imaginative thinking about how to adapt to the challenges we face as an aging society. As we wrote in our forthcoming book, American Dementia, one of the most compelling recent research findings is that dementia rates have been in decline in the U.S., Canada, and U.K., France, Sweden, and Netherlands over the past decade. This trend has little to do with biotechnology and has much to do with mid-20th century public policy that increased total years of education for those now in their retirement years via the GI Bill and investment in state colleges and universities in the U.S. Expanded healthcare and improved treatment of risk factors that affect the brain, such as vascular disease and high cholesterol. Remarkably successful smoking cessation programs and deleting gasoline. In combination, these state actions in service of public health are believed by most experts, including the Lancet Commission on Dementia Prevention, to have enhanced the cognitive reserve of today's older adults. A field not captured by industry might ask whether 21st century governments are capable of engendering such population-level actions focused on improving larger institutions, structures, and social processes that benefit brain health. Arguably, achieving universal health care and higher education and addressing the nation's aging water pipe infrastructure, which has yielded a modern-day lead crisis, could be expected to make similar contributions to brain health across decades. So too would provision of long-term care insurance provide material security for elders who currently live in a precarious situation, wherein the U.S. government won't pay for care through Medicaid until they spend down essentially all their assets. Moreover, we have observed in our combined 7 decades of work the profound effects in the arts and dementia care environments. Music, dance, storytelling, expressive artwork, gardening, intergenerational activities, pet therapy, and other creative relationship-oriented approaches that tap into quintessential elements of our humanity improve quality of life for elders and their caregivers far more than current drugs, including Aduhelm. These socialceuticals deserve our investment, even if they are not commodities that will ultimately generate revenue for industry. Ultimately, Aduhelm reflects the forces that have led to the Alzheimer's field, that have led the Alzheimer's field astray in the 21st century. When industry drives research incentives and when a hypothesis becomes too big to fail, we squander scarce resources, lose precious time, and fail to properly adapt to one of the major challenges of our era. Okay, and as a follow-up to that, a little bit of an update on where Aduhelm is, this from Stat News. Biogen admits Aduhelm launch, quote, slower than we anticipated. Biogen CEO Michael Venatsos admitted last Thursday that the launch of Aduhelm, the company's intensely scrutinized treatment for Alzheimer's disease, has been slower than we anticipated. Only about 50 centers around the country have administered at least one dose of Aduhelm, which won FDA approval on June 7th, Biogen said in an investor conference. That has led Biogen to revisit its already very low sales target for 2021. Biogen's share prices fell nearly 6% during the company's presentation. Wall Street earning estimates for Biogen implied that about 12,000 patients were receiving Aduhelm, suggesting a massive disparity between investor expectations and commercial reality. The company has lost nearly 25% of its value since Aduhelm was approved. Meanwhile, members of Congress have demanded information from both Biogen and the FDA about how Aduhelm was approved, citing stats reporting that the company had an off-the-books meeting with a top agency official. The Department of Health and Human Services Office of Inspector General is conducting a separate investigation into the FDA's use of a fast-track pathway to approve Aduhelm. Yeah, I had made a prediction a number of episodes back that the rollout of Aduhelm would be much less than what people feared. That's a good thing. That the complexity and the adversity experienced by clinicians being very skeptical and the complexity of actually administering it, regardless of the cost, is really difficult clinically. So it looks like maybe Aduhelm will go more or less by the wayside due to these great complexities and barriers.
And now a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones? From daily sexism that can't be mansplained away? From endemic racism that nobody seems to see? Try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning, use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted, or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever, callous always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
Okay, well, this next story closes off our little segment with a story from Stat News about how our so-called free market in healthcare is not working well. Outdated rule increases Medicare's cost for generic drugs by $26 billion a year. Public outcry about a shockingly high cost of brand name drugs and demand for new laws to rein in the cost of these medicines has persisted for years. But more than 90% of all prescriptions, almost $4 billion a year, are filled with generic drugs. Little attention has been paid to how much insurance companies, pharmacy benefits managers, and pharmacies charge to fill these generic prescriptions. Yet the difference between the highest and lowest price being charged for the same generic drug is so large that many billions of dollars could be saved each year by having prescriptions filled at the lowest cost pharmacies. The entry of companies like Amazon and GoodRx into the business of filling prescriptions is a game changer. They are offering prices far lower than the federal government pays insurance plans to have these prescriptions filled under the Medicare Part D drug benefit. Repealing the current Part D benefit, designing and replacing it with a system in which the government directly reimburses low-cost pharmacies for filling generic prescriptions would save about $18 billion a year. Patients would save an additional $8 billion in out-of-pocket co-payments because the prices these pharmacies charge do not require any form of insurance or any additional co-payment. How is it possible the cost of filling generic prescriptions can vary so widely? The answer resides in a lack of transparency about the true cost of generic medicines. The World Health Organization estimates that generic versions of essential medicines can be profitably produced at a 99% discount from the cost of the patented brand name medicine. So a patented pill that sells for a dollar can be profitably produced and sold as a generic for a penny. In fact, generic manufacturers now sell many of the most widely prescribed generic drugs in the U.S. for 1 cent to 5 cents per pill. Competition between generic manufacturers assures that these pills are offered for sale at a small profit over the actual cost to produce them. Yet in a few instances where such competition is lacking, as was the case for the generic version of the EpiPen, the cost of generic drugs may sell at only a small discount from the brand name product. Insurance plans and pharmacy benefit managers price their generic prescriptions at levels the market will bear, rather than at a reasonable markup from the actual cost of acquiring and dispensing the prescription. Patients and payers believe they are getting a bargain when they get a 70% discount and pay 30 cents per pill for the generic version of a branded medicine for which they previously paid a dollar. They have no idea that the pharmacy acquired that pill for only a penny or two and is marking up each pill by 10 to 20 times its acquisition cost. The high markup imposed by insurance plans and pharmacy benefit managers explains why the government pays 26 cents a pill for atorvastatin while Amazon sells it for 5 cents a pill. Discount pharmacies like Amazon are disrupting the prescription drug market by pricing their prescriptions on a cost-plus basis while still earning a fair profit. A 90-day prescription for a generic medicine acquired for a cost of 1 cent per pill has an ingredient cost of 90 cents. The average dispensing cost, the pharmacy's cost for the time spent to count and package the pills, label the pills, comply with laws for keeping prescription records, and record the information required for reimbursement from insurance plans, is about $2.40 per prescription. If a discounted pharmacy charges $5 for this 90-day prescription, it will earn $1.70 profit over the actual $3.30 cost of the prescription. That amounts to a gross profit of 34%, which compares favorably with reported profit margins of independent pharmacies. For a 90-day prescription, adding 10 cents to the cost of each pill would add $9 to the cost of the prescription. That doesn't sound like much, but doing that for 4 billion prescriptions translates to $36 billion. Medicare should be able to fill generic prescriptions at the lowest price charged for those prescriptions in the competitive retail market. But the 2003 law that created Part D prohibits the government from shopping for the best price and gives private insurance plans exclusive authority to set the price. The Republican administration that championed the enactment of Part D erroneously believed that competition between insurance companies results in the lowest prices and the widest choices for beneficiaries. No such competition ever materialized. Instead, Part D created windfall profits for private insurance plans and pharmacy benefit managers while needlessly adding complexity to the process of filling generic prescriptions. Patients are now faced with an incomprehensible array of formularies, quantity limitations, and co-payments that often make it cheaper to pay for a generic drug out of pocket than to use their Part D insurance. The current design of the Part D benefit is ill-suited to a world in which discount pharmacies fill generic prescriptions at affordable prices without insurance. A new design that eliminates expensive intermediaries and relies on price competition between pharmacies will not only drastically lower costs in Part D, but will also force all pharmacies to lower their profit margins if they hope to compete for the Part D prescriptions that account for 30% of the retail pharmacy business. Part D prices for generic drugs would quickly become the benchmark for private payers and drive down the prices and copayments for generic drug prescriptions in private insurance plans. The end result would be that more than 90% of all prescriptions could be filled at a lower cost to payers without burdening patients with significant additional out-of-pocket costs. Senate Democrats are now negotiating a $3.5 trillion soft infrastructure package that will include legislation to lower patient out-of-pocket costs in Part D and expand Medicare to cover vision, dental, and hearing services by imposing new taxes. This proposal to lower Medicare's cost of dispensing generic drugs and the Biden's administration proposal to limit price increases on brand name drugs could produce enough savings in the cost of current Medicare prescription drug benefits to pay for the proposed expansion of Medicare benefits without such taxes. Given the rising resistance to moderate Democrats to the $3.5 trillion price tag of the proposed infrastructure package, paying for new benefits by reducing the cost of existing ones may be the wisest path forward. Okay, well, I want to end the show with a couple stories that are a little bit better news, I suppose. This from Science Daily. Over 200 health journals call on world leaders to address catastrophic harm to health from climate change. Over 200 health journals across the world have come together to simultaneously publish an editorial calling on world leaders to take emergency action to limit global temperature increases, halt the destruction of nature, and protect health. The editorial has been published ahead of the UN General Assembly this week, one of the last international meetings taking place before the COP26 climate conference in Glasgow, UK, in November. This is a crucial moment to urge all countries to deliver enhanced and ambitious climate plans to honor the goals of the Paris Agreement, the international treaty on climate change adopted by 195 countries in 2015. The editorial urges governments to intervene to transform societies and economies, for example, by supporting the redesign of transport systems, cities, production and distribution of food, markets for financial investment, and health systems. Substantial investment will be needed, but this will have huge positive health and economic benefits, including high-quality jobs, reduced air pollution, increased physical activity, and improved housing and diet, explained the authors. Crucially, cooperation hinges on wealthy nations doing more. In particular, countries that have disproportionately created the environmental crisis must do more to support low- and middle-income countries to build cleaner, healthier, and more resilient societies. Saye Abinbola, editor-in-chief of the British medical journal Global Health, said, "What we must do to tackle pandemics, health inequities, and climate change is the same. Global solidarity and action that recognize that within and across nations, our destinies are inextricably linked, just as human health is inextricably linked to the health of the planet." And lastly, from The Hill, EPA to propose first-ever forever chemical discharge limits. The Environmental Protection Agency announced last Wednesday that it will propose a rule to set the first-ever limits on the amount of chemicals called PFAS that can be discharged. In a new plan, the agency affirmed that it would propose rule-setting limits for PFAS wastewater discharges from facilities that manufacture the substances, as well as from chromium electroplating facilities. Certain types of PFAS, an acronym that stands for per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, have been linked to health issues including types of cancer and problems with the immune system. They are sometimes called forever chemicals because they can accumulate in nature in the human body. The plan also says that the agency revised rules surrounding discharges of nutrient pollutants, such as phosphorus, from facilities that slaughter or process meat and poultry that were last updated in 2004. So this is good news for us in Toledo here, who live near Lake Erie and have algal blooms and stuff, is that maybe we'll actually have some effect on the amount of CRAP that comes our way and pollutes our environment, our lakes, and our water. Okay, well, last but not least, we have the bonus articles that are available online, and I'll give you the link at the end, which you can read these articles or the articles that I've had in this episode. Number one, health effects of 9/11 still plague responders and survivors. Two, the absurd pregnancy math behind the six-week abortion ban. Three, adolescent mental health. There's a vaccine for that. School-based interventions that help students regulate their emotions in healthy ways have proved effective at preventing pandemic-related issues. Four, any qualms about an extra COVID vaccine dose? Stat readers respond. Thought this was a good summary of the issues about the extra COVID dose. And lastly, but not least, five, Americans are losing sight of the pandemic endgame. Entirely eliminating infections is an unrealistic goal, but successful vaccines will avoid the worst outcomes. You can see these at toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Jon Snow Memorial Studio. Jon Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some